Attention crew, this is your Captain Caliban speaking. This is a supplemental episode of Enterprising Individuals, where we bring you news and tidbits from the world of Trek, also interviews with special guests, and a few little surprises along the way. We've got a great interview for you this week and a bit of a blast from the past. Last fall, I spoke with Justin McLaughlin. Justin is the creator of the EOS 10 podcast, a sci-fi comedy audio drama set aboard an intergalactic travel hub on the edges of deep space. And he's also the author of the book Treknology, Star Trek's Tech 300 Years Ahead of the Future. Justin is a writer and a creator. He's also one of the voices on EOS 10. And I wanted to get his thoughts on creating for podcasts for an audio medium and find out how his fandom and his love of Trek influences what he creates today. Just a note, we did record this a while ago in October of last year, so we're talking about the pandemic, but this was before the presidential election and the release of the various vaccines. There's not too much current events talk, but just FYI, this is a missive from an earlier time. Also, an extra note, we had a few technical glitches during the recording, nothing earth-shaking, but the sound quality is a bit lower than what we usually present. I really enjoyed talking with Justin. I would sincerely encourage you to listen to EOS 10, which is a funny and a very well-made show. I believe they're currently working on a fifth season of the show, so there's plenty of content there for you to check out. Also, we don't talk about this in the interview, but Justin's production company, Planet M, has just launched an online magazine, Galaxy Q, where they write about pop culture news and sci-fi and fantasy topics. You can find that at planet.io/Galaxy Q. I'll leave a link in the show notes for it, as well as links for where you can find EOS 10 and Justin's book, Treknology. That's it for me this week. We'll be back on Wednesday with a new episode. On Wednesdays, I carry Star Trek. And with that, let's get underway. My guest on the show today is Justin McLaughlin. Justin is an actor, writer, and director, and he's the creator of EOS 10, an audio fiction podcast about two maladjusted doctors and their medical team on board an intergalactic travel hub on the edges of deep space. He's also the author of Treknology, Star Trek's Tech 300 Years Ahead of the Future. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
It's great to have you aboard. I always ask new guests on the show how they first became Star Trek fans. How did you first discover Star Trek?
That is a big story, actually, because it involves my parents giving me a tiny, like a little 19-inch television that I think they were done with. They didn't give me cable, just the television, so I put it in my room, and they got one channel out of Pittsburgh every night at 7, and every night at 7, they broadcast Star Trek, and that was pretty much all I had to watch, but I think I was enamored pretty quickly, because it soon became a dominant force in my life, I guess.
Yeah. That's pretty cool that you got a TV in your bedroom. My parents never would have gone for that.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised too.
I think my parents were a little worried about how much TV that I consumed. But, it was all good because now I have a show about a TV show.
So. Yeah.
So it paid off. And I'm sure watching all those shows for you inspired you to want to be a creator as well.
I think so. I think it's really where my sort of connection to that kind of storytelling, particularly like episodic storytelling, really started early on. Yeah, it's been sort of this lifelong sort of love affair. I'll tell you, I don't remember how old I was even when MacGyver ended, but I distinctly remember that series finale and that show ending, and then I just started crying, and I said something, I just blurted out, like, I hate you, Richard Dean Anderson. I had read in TV Guide or something that he was the one who decided not to continue on, so there's gonna be no more MacGyver stories, and like that, just that feeling of grief and loss, like I was so young, but it was so strong, and that's just kind of, I just have that connection. It's not here as much now that I'm an adult, I'll tell you that. And I being more on the other side of creating those stories, I think it can ruin you a little bit. But man, when I was little, I was attached to the stories that I really enjoyed.
I loved MacGyver as well, and I especially loved it because Richard Dean Anderson was from Minnesota, my state.
So, oh, yeah.
Something of a local hero. But did that keep you from watching Stargate?
You know what? Actually, I did not watch Stargate. Never did. Maybe I was just like, I don't want to, but I just don't want to talk. I don't want to see this guy anymore. I hate him. No, I think I see commercials for it sometimes still. Or like memes on the online, and I'm just like, yeah, I should probably watch that at some point.
Yeah, I don't think that I don't have like a conscious ban on watching other space shows because I'm a big Star Trek fan, but I feel like it kind of fell out that way. You know, when I was watching DS9, I wasn't really watching Babylon 5. And when I was watching, you know, Voyager, I wasn't really watching Stargate. And so it just sort of, now that I'm an adult, you know, I'm going on this journey to try to go back and catch up on this stuff. But at the time, yeah, it didn't really register for me. I like the movie. I just never really watched the TV show.
Yeah, it can be hard, right? You know, you live in one world and then try to cross in this other one. And you're like, why do their ships do that? Ships don't do that in space.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't see Star Wars until, I was over 30 for sure.
Really?
Yeah, wow. Yeah. I got in trouble when the new movies were out, and I remember there was the trailer with the Millennium Falcon real prominent in it, and I was like, is that the ship Harrison Ford flies? I got in so much trouble for asking that question. I was just like, I don't know. I don't. It's just like, you know what you know. You know what you like, and I have no problem. I think it's great. I really, honestly, I don't want no Star Wars fans, please, tweeting at me. I get it. I love it. It's on it. They're fun. I love them. No war for me, but...
Yeah. what made you want to be an actor?
A question I ask myself every day of my life. You know, I don't know. Maybe I was a little bit of a narcissist as a kid. I don't know. I felt really kind of like... I just loved being on... I was fascinated. I was fascinated with what went in behind the scenes and what you saw on the front end. And so I think, you know, I grew up living on a stage. I think high school, I went to school and I think we got at like 2:30, and then I went straight to the theater and I was there till, you know, some nights 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night. That was my life for years and years and years and years. So I drifted away through college just to do something else. And eventually I came back and I just could not escape it. There's just something about, I wish I had an answer, because then maybe I could fix it and do something else that's easier or more stable, or I don't know. It's just because it's such a hard industry in so many ways, but
yeah,
there's nothing else like it for me. So I guess that's what I'm supposed to be doing.
You know, you have a very successful audio fiction podcast, and I should say that you're also the creator of the Heroics audio fiction podcast as well. And radio plays and audio fiction have become very popular in the podcasting sphere. It's kind of ironic that the futuristic technology of podcasts is delivering radio plays. I mean, it's right there in the name, technology that podcasts are supplanting in a lot of ways. Why do you think that the radio play, a century-old form of entertainment, is thriving online?
Well, I think one of the most obvious explanations is probably just the ease behind it. I mean, I think people jump into this and it looks deceptively simple from the outside, but there is, you know, it's not the same as having to cart around an entire crew and a camera crew and getting locations, even though we're actually pushing more towards recording on location and outside of studios. But I think it looks like it's not as intimidating, you know, it's just something that I think people can jump into. But then I have all kinds of theories about, you know, just psychologically what I think this format does that, you know, reading a book doesn't do or watching a movie doesn't do. It just engages you in, I think, a really sweet spot for a lot of people, being able to listen and kind of engage their imaginations just enough, but not have it fed to them like a movie would, if that makes sense. So I think, I don't know, it appeals to people on both ends. And so what's happened in the last 5-10 years, you've just really seen this kind of like a community build up around it. There's definitely a particular person who I think really goes for these, really enjoys this kind of storytelling.
That's interesting. You know, it helps too that the corporate interests are getting involved. You know, there's platforms like Audible delivering star-studded adaptations of novels and comic books and original material as well. I have not indulged myself yet, but I've heard the commercials for the Sandman adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And being a big fan of the comic book, it was like, maybe want to check that out.
Yeah, they lend some legitimacy to it that otherwise might not be there. And you know, when I talk with different companies, and they all have different goals for why they're doing it too. And I think you see like Audible really jumping into like licensing content and sort of moving sort of the way, you know, Amazon Studios did in terms of going from selling other people's stories to creating their own. And places like Spotify, and I think also some of these companies are seeing like this is way cheaper content that people are just craving that we can produce. So they're just exploring what they can do. And you know, I like some of them will tell me like, we don't want to be just an IP factory. We want to have really good stories that can only be told in audio. And I think that's great. And then other ones are like, we're just really looking to like test out new talent and ideas, and we want the IP. And I'm like, that's great too. Whatever your motives are, let's create more things and get more stories out there. So
I think it'd be interesting if, you know, Amazon does this. They've got like James McAvoy and Jesse Eisenberg fronted podcasts, and they go a couple more years and then they just ghost and disappear because apparently it wasn't profitable enough for them in the space. And then all that's left is like the real people creating good shows like you.
Yeah. And I do wonder about it's this sort of entertainment industry mentality about, if you just put the right actor out front, it'll draw an audience.
Yeah.
You have a lot of people who are really exceptional at spotting people with big names and not necessarily understanding what people in this, I think in this genre are really looking for in a story. And it's not necessarily the really big name talent. And like, no offense to big name talent, they're great, or anyone that wants to work with them. I'm just not sure that's the right approach, but I'm not sure the industry knows any other approach.
Yeah, like nobody know. I mean, no offense to Cecil Baldwin, but like, you know, he wasn't a household name when Night Vale started, but now, you know, they're filling up theaters and they're selling millions of dollars in merchandise, and it's working out okay.
Yeah, for sure. It's just no one knows what's going to work, so they go back to things that have worked in the past.
Yeah.
Without really understanding why it worked, they just wanted to work again. And so they're playing the odds, so it's hard to blame them. It's confusing. It's really confusing. You never know what people are going to respond to. It's never what you think.
Well, the core of it, of course, is good storytelling, though. Where did the inspiration for EOS 10 arise from?
I'm married to a doctor. I don't know if a lot of people know that.
Oh.
And at the time, I think the only people I knew were doctors. We moved around a lot through the training period. Doctors trained for many, 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 many years. Yeah. And without me having like an office job all the time, like the only people I knew were people that I met that way. So I was fascinated by how doctors, what my impression was of doctors before I knew any personally versus my impression of doctors after all my friends became doctors. And it was a radical change. And I suddenly saw them as people deeply flawed, and it was kind of a story that was in my mind. And to be honest, I started writing it, I think I had maybe just started acting again and had an audition for this TV show, and TV was not something that I had normally done at that point. And you know, I didn't book it, and I think I was just really depressed about it and wanted something creative to do. So I started writing EOS 10, and I mean, if I knew now how many auditions I had ahead of me to not book, I might not have gotten so upset about it. But at that point, it didn't feel good. So I was like, I need something to just give me some creative output. And next thing I knew, I had like 8 scripts, and I was like, okay, maybe I can find some actors and I can record this. And I did, and I put it online. And then one night I was scrolling through Tumblr and I saw this drawing that someone had done of one of the characters. And I was like, oh, wow, people are listening.
Yeah.
And I think that was the moment I realized that I had this thing that I had to kind of take care of that I wasn't even sure people would ever
keep doing this.
I was like, oh, what did I do? How did that happen? It's been a wonderful sort of outlet to keep me moving. This is an industry of not just of ups and downs, but of like busy, really not busy, not sure you'll ever work again, kind of back and forth, and just to always kind of have this to be there. People are remarkably patient when you have the thing that they want. They'll wait for it.
Right, yeah.
But no, I mean, this audience is an endured really long. It's like we're a British TV show. They just wait for it. I try my best and things, you know, I'm super appreciative of the fact that people have just stuck by it for so long. You just, all I hear is there more? Is there more? Tell me more. What happens next? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, we want there to be more. So it's just, It's the reality. You know, one thing I don't do is ask people to work for free. You know, we don't generally pay people with, no one gets rich, let me put it that way. Like, I value the contributions that they make, and the one way we can do show them that is to pay them. We're fortunate enough to be in that position. I know a lot of shows aren't, and I just some rules that I made for myself that I think have made it harder, but it's, you know, there's lines that there are values that are important to me, so I try to put those into what I do and treat the people that collaborate with me as best I can. I was just talking this morning with this about some friends about a production company who actually on its own figured out how to get its actors more money from a client for a commercial they were producing. We're like, that's so rare. Like, we wouldn't even have known we were owed more money. And it's just, it's things like that. Like, I want to be that part of the industry, not the part that we're always like, what are these people doing? Or like, look what these monsters did today. So,
right. Yeah.
I don't want to be the monster that anybody's talking about behind my back.
Did your trek in sci-fi fandom affect or influence the writing of EOS?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I think if you know the show, both shows, you're going to see where sort of the antecedents are and like where we get storyline ideas that we can then twist. Or, I think it was someone else. It's bad that I don't know this. I think it was fourth season, actually. I think we have a joke where, I think it's Brian says, like, make it so. And one of the characters is like, what the hell does that mean? What do you want me to do? Like, no, do it. Like, make it so. And they go back and forth, like, what? Well, why don't you just say it the right way? And it's just like, it's something that I don't think, unless you watch The Next Generation, you probably have no idea what that joke was. You might still enjoy it, but I think it's just stuff like that that really that seeps in, that if you're a fan of both, you're going to pick up those little pieces and be like, oh, okay. And even, sometimes I don't even realize that I do it. Like, we have a character named Maddox, and someone pointed out to me, and I think it helped that Picard had come out, and they're like, you know, that character Bruce Maddox was kind of important in the Star Trek mythology. And I was like, oh yeah, that's probably why I named that character Maddox. That's what I did, you know?
Sure.
And it's just,
sure.
It's part of the background of who I am. So I think it's going to sneak in there intentionally, and more often than not at this point, even unintentionally. I just don't even realize or recognize that it's happening.
I mean, so many creators grew up loving it, and it's an institution that's been around forever that I think its influence on media is undeniable. And even when a show or work tries to be an answer to Trek or says, like, this ain't Star Trek, it's still self-consciously like a reaction to Trek. And I think that's gotten Trek, it's gotten Trek in trouble in a sense. You know, Trek is so consistent. It has such a distinct feel. And now the franchise is expanding with all these new shows, which are self-consciously trying to reach new markets and demographics and tell different stories. And I think the number one complaint you hear from critics of new Trek shows is that they don't feel like Star Trek, whatever that may entail.
Yeah, it's a little bit of nostalgia, right? For what is gone. That same feeling that I kind of had as like, just the grief you feel when you realize there's no more stories with this character or this group of characters.
And yeah.
I totally get that. I really do. And what I try to do with these shows, especially now, is search for where the common ground is. Just to kind of reassure myself that, you know, it's still there. That core is still underneath there. And then kind of branch out and see, okay, why did they make this change? Did they not understand how important this was in the mythology? Is it a reflection of the creators, the writers, the producers? Or was there like a really good reason behind it? And I think it's kind of up to you what your answer is, what it comes out. Because I think we've all kind of attached onto things that are really important to us about this universe, and for some others they might not be as important. I think, you know, my brother had just brought up something to me that we were talking about, how Star Trek is a post-scarcity society, and it's not, I had thought about it on that level, but not in such clear terms, because I asked, you know, he's a political scientist and a lawyer, and I said, you know, what does it take for us to get to that future? And he was like, when 9 out of 10 people don't need to work anymore, that's the future we'll have. Because we didn't have sort of capitalism wasn't really kind of possible until we didn't have to work on farms, where 9 out of 10 people could do something other than just produce the food we needed to survive. And it's kind of those shifts in society. Yeah. So those kind of questions are really important to me about Star Trek, and I love when the show kind of delves into those issues and explains and gives us more of that. And some other people I talk to about it are like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I just like Data. And I'm like, okay, you're great.
Sure.
I love Data too. Really love Data too. So it's just such a rich, I was going to say tapestry, but I mean, it is. It's just such a rich, rich tapestry that you can pull so many threads and be miles apart, but still know that you're connected by this sort of, this common vision.
Yeah.
That was a lot of words to say something really simple.
No, but it all, yeah, it makes sense. When you began writing and creating EOS, did you have a particular feel in mind for the show, or did you find it in the process of just doing it?
I wanted the characters to be, I was pushing towards sort of, I don't want to say cartoon because I don't want to give people the wrong idea, but I was definitely pushing towards those sort of bolder, more substantial choices in terms of polarizing the personalities of the people. So kind of in the way you'd see, like if you remember the animated show King of the Hill, or I think at the time Archer is still on, but Archer was pretty new when we were starting. So those were kind of in the background for me, where I wanted to go tonally. So I knew it was going to be comedy. I don't think I understood at the time how broad we were going to end up going. I mean, if you told me that I would be known for some of the jokes that I'm not known for, or, like 10 years ago, I'd be like, no, I don't even laugh at jokes like that. I would never write a joke like that. And now it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I did write that. I'm not sure why, but that was me. I made that up. So it's just, I say now that there are two kinds of EOS 10 episodes. The characters are either in a really like life and death, serious, dramatic situation that they respond to just completely ridiculously, or they're in a ridiculous situation that they treat really serious and like a matter of life and death. And that's sort of the framework that I think we start from now. It takes some time to get that clarity for sure. But I think the more time that you spend kind of asking yourself those questions ahead of time, the quicker you get to a really great result. You can get there by a lot of different processes, but I feel it's really important to answer those questions and make those choices early on in the process. And I've done that to varying degrees of success.
And you are Ryan Dallas on the show as well, and you produce and you direct the shows as well. I know it's a lot of hats to wear. I know in your short film work, you've directed actors. How is it different directing voice actors rather than actors in live action?
I think I do a lot more work helping them envision where they are and what's happening. It's really easy when you're standing behind that microphone in the studio to just start reading lines, which, you know, like everyone's good. Like everyone can make a line reading sound really good. But then sometimes you get back to the studio and you're like, yeah, but it's really windy and loud, and the voices don't kind of match. And so just giving them just sort of a really strong foundation. And you know, I've talked with my engineers, like what would it take to, you know, put some backgrounds in their headphones so they can hear the sounds of the environment. Anything to just help them visualize where they are and what's happening, because I mean, quite frankly, they do most of the rest of the work on their own. They're just great. So it's just, on a rare occasion when I need to make sure a line is delivered a certain way, just because it sets something up or makes something make sense, I you know, I'll put a little tiny direction into the script. But at this point with the EOS 10 cast, I just let them fly. They just know what they're doing. Heroics was kind of, they came in really well, you know, like they hit the ground running really hard. They were just such great. We managed to just cast such great voice actors for that show. But I think some people love working with me and some people don't necessarily, because my style is just kind of like, you know, if I'm talking to you about your performance, that's usually when something isn't working. If I'm not talking to you, it's because there are a thousand other things and you're working, you're great, so I'm just gonna leave you alone. I find that it's easier here. I think in LA that's kind of because of the pace at which like TV production and things move. I think actors here are more cognizant of that, but sometimes you have actors who need a little more they need a little more what's the word I'm looking for I don't want to just say praise, but they need a little more confidence boosting and a little more kind of, you're doing great. And I don't always, it's not always time for that. And I try so hard. I always say thank you after a take ends, and then I'll come back like 5 minutes later. By the way, that was fantastic. I love you. You're awesome. And it's true.
Actors love that.
They do. And they're doing, it's, you know, it's hard work. It's, you're really, they're so often the most visible face of a project, and they have the least control over it. So sure. It's just kind of, I love actors and I really try hard to take care of them and protect them because I know what it's like to be in those situations and what it feels like sometimes. And I do, this was in Heroics. One of the actors, he plays Nolan, his name's Jake Elitzer, has this unbelievable voice. And he's giving me all these great takes on this one line, and he's just trying things. And it was just, finally I was just like, you know, can you just say it like you just want an answer to the question? Like, can you just be really basic? And everyone just died laughing, and I was like, oh, no, I didn't mean that to be like rude or anything. I just want it really simple. And he was like, yeah, I can do it simple. So I mean, actors are amazing, and he took that really well. But I was just wasn't thinking about what I was saying or how I was saying it, and I was just like, sorry.
Has COVID-19 affected production at Planet M?
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to... We haven't put anyone in the studio. Wow, it was January. I think we stopped.
Sure.
And we've had some stuff done, but it's usually with an actor who has access to like a home studio and will sit, you know, by themselves. And Charles Lipper plays Levi. You know, he has his own studio, so we record a lot of ES10 in his studio, and he's done some stuff... since then, because he has the capacity to do it at home, but safety is pretty much my number one priority always. And like I said, being married to a doctor, I kind of have a different view than I think a lot of people do. So I know some people are out there working now, and I know that they've got good heads on their shoulders, and they'll take precautions, and they understand the risks, and I understand why they have to do it. I fear for them, and I don't want to put anyone in that situation, but I'm also hopeful that we're starting to develop protocols and learn more about how this works, and particularly with audio, that I think we can do some stuff more remotely. And it kind of sucks, because we were getting to a point where we were really starting to experiment with like on location recording, getting out of studios, and if I have a scene with two people in a park, like taking them to a park and letting them and just recording them in the park and stuff like that, that we kind of have to slow down on. But I think we're more fortunate that we can just kind of ride this out than a lot of other places that really rely, you know, they have huge payrolls. When for us, it's just temporary. You know, we hire people per project. So,
well, hopefully you'll be able to return to the studio soon. Can you talk about your EOS spinoff?
Yeah, EOS 10 Command is a spinoff, and it's about the captain of EOS 10, whom we've never before we've mentioned, but I don't believe we've ever had on screen or had any character directly interact or really even talk about how they've interacted. Like, these two worlds we've really kind of kept separate. So the show is going to dive more into what happens in the operations center. And we've talked a little bit, I think, in the original series about a place called The Void, and that becomes really, really important in EOS 10 Command. I don't want to give too much of it away, but it's going to be kind of the central theme, is not the right word, but sort of a central plot device in this new show. Mm-hmm. So we were really fortunate to have the help of an independent film project to kind of connect with, like we talked about earlier, companies that are out there looking for audio and buying audio. So we've had a lot of great meetings in the past couple of weeks and a couple more to go. So I'm really hopeful that this show is going to happen. It's still a fingers crossed. I really think it's going to. I think one way or the other we'll get it out there. But I'm excited for where this could go. I'm excited about the breadth of stories that I think you could tell on a place like EOS 10. And I've been rewatching Deep Space Nine.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And it just, I'll tell you, I did not realize how well plotted and developed that show was from launch. It strikes me as a show that had a really good idea of where it was headed from day one. I just think its conceptions and ideas, and even if like we can nitpick execution and things like that, I just think there's some just really amazing, rich storytelling in that show, and they invented just some really cool, you know, science fiction ideas that I'm sure have been done before, but not that I had seen, and just kind of, I have come to love that show in a way that I had not before. Maybe it's just because the world is insane, and it's a show where you very much watch the good guys fight the bad guys for like 7 seasons, and you can root for the hero, and it's just, I don't know, I think it's great. I've come to love it in a way I didn't when I first watched it.
I remember just when it came out, you know, originally on TV, being kind of disappointed because it wasn't, you know, a spaceship show where they were going to fly around everywhere. And so that sort of disappointment kind of following my watching of the series, and I didn't finish it. I just kind of lost interest or attention. And then coming back to it as an adult and being like, wow, like it just echoing all the things that you said, like this is just so well planned, and they weren't just, you know, waiting for just some new idea or some new monster to meet, just the things that they wanted to try to accomplish, and the way that they accomplished, as far as I can tell, pretty much all of them. Like it's a really an amazing accomplishment in sci-fi storytelling on TV.
Yeah, it's just so underrated. It does not get the praise that is due. And I think I was 7. I would have been in high school. I was 17 when I came to LA to work on this show called Channel One News. I don't know if anyone outside of high school back then would even know what that is, but it was a news program that was broadcast to high schools. And Lisa Ling got her start there. Anderson Cooper got his start there. Really great journalists have come out of this show. But anyways, their studio was Rally Studios. It's this little place on Melrose Avenue right across from Paramount Pictures. So the first time they brought me out, you know, I lived up in Universal City in the Universal Sheraton, and they would drive me down to the studio every day when they were taping the show. And so I had like the equivalent of like set teachers watching me. I actually did homework in my hotel room for 2 hours every morning, and then they brought me down. But when I got there, I was like, so look, Paramount Pictures is right across the road. I'm going over there one way or the other, so you should probably find a way to do it so I don't get arrested. Because I'm going. Like, I've never been this close to, like, a Star Trek set in my life, and I am not letting go of this opportunity. And they did, and unfortunately, we could not go on the Voyager set. It was hot. But I saw Kate Mulgrew walking from our trailer onto the stage. And then, for some reason, Deep Space Nine was in production. They were not shooting that day. And they had left one of the huge garage doors on, I forget which stage it was, whatever stage the promenade was open, so we just kind of slipped in and walked around the promenade. It was completely dark. Oh, there was equipment everywhere, but I was like, I was 17, and I was in heaven. Like, I could have died happy that day. I cannot tell you. It is one of the most vivid memories of my entire life. It was amazing.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, good luck on your new show. I want to talk about your book, Trekology. One of the things I really like about the book is your individual voice in it. I mean, there are a lot of books about the science of Trek, the physics of Trek, the technology, and they're usually written by experts in those fields, and they're more than happy to explain how we could, say, you know, replicate something today with 3D printers or whatever. Or conversely, like, here's why we'll never be able to achieve warp speed or transporters or what have you. But in your book, you draw upon your experience as a journalist to talk with experts and assess the state of current technology. And your conclusion is that we're kind of already living in the Trek future in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I honestly think we are. I mean, there are a few key pieces that are probably much beyond our capabilities at the moment. But I mean, I don't know. There's just so many analog, like touch screens are the obvious thing. You know, those were so futuristic in the late 80s and 90s. And like, I'm talking to you on one, you know, like,
right. Yeah.
They're just everywhere. So if you really look at a lot of the technology, a lot of it has arrived. The ones that everyone wants are not, you know, like holodecks, transporters, those things are not here yet. Might not be for a very long time. I don't know. I have an Oculus headset. It's not a holodeck, but it's pretty cool. Like, so I get the appeal.
Sure.
Like, I want one, yes, but it's just the way, some things I think that the way they worked on the show, they may never work in real life.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's an indictment of the show at all. It's just real life sneaks up on you sometimes, and there are practical challenges that we would have to deal with in real life that TV writers don't.
Yeah, right.
But I think they put a lot of this in the public consciousness, right? I mean, I think they are responsible in a lot of ways. You know, the guys who loved Star Trek watching Data, watching his fingers fly across the touchscreen, are the guys that then, you know, went on and made those touchscreens in real life within a few decades. And then, you know, it's funny, we saw Picard and it's full of holograms. So you have to wonder what UIs are coming down the road in just a decade or two, based on what we're doing in science fiction now.
It's interesting. We've had that conversation on this show before, just whether these ideas, you know, push from Trek, push real science forward, or is the people of Trek just sort of seeing trends? And I think it's interesting that, like, even if Trek isn't directly influencing ideas about technology, there's often a sense of convergent evolution. You talk in the book about how Mike Okuda designed, you know, the instantly recognizable LCARS interface, which is just plastic cutouts, you know, on the show, but he didn't have any big ideas about how the OS would operate. But Star Trek did, I think, influence our ideas about smartphones, as we talked about. And when you've got a touchscreen cell phone, your fingertip is the interface point. So you make everything a picture or a square or something. And you fast forward to Windows 8, which was made for touchscreens and Windows phones. And now we've got an OS with squares and shapes that looks like LCARS. Like, you know, it all goes back to Trek anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, either they were, like you said, they were really just tuned in to what was coming, with combined that with great imaginations and the ability to sort of experiment. And yeah, it brings us to the question of when life imitates art or art imitates life. It's probably like a big mix of both.
Robotic science on Earth is getting better. It's improving by leaps and bounds, literally, because we have robots that do backflips and run up and down stairs. But the uncanny valley seems to be unleapable, though, because our robots don't look human at all. And every time they try to put, like, fake skin on a robot and give it a face, it's horrifying. I don't know if we're ever going to get a Data.
It would be really hard, right? I mean, I wonder, too, I look at what we do in, like, 3D modeling and 3D and photo, like, photorealistic modeling, and you know, I see the boundaries that artists are pushing in that format. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, would they ever be able to create something that could fool us in real life so that those sort of emotional responses aren't triggered when we look at it? I think you're right. I think it's going to be really, really hard, because I think there's just something that we don't understand about how we perceive each other and how, when I look at a face, what my brain is actually registering. Now, if we get more information about that and figure that out, then yeah, maybe. But and the other two points are, maybe we'll figure out we don't want a Data. Maybe we want our robots to look this way, or that sort of uncanny valley feeling that we have right now could theoretically be selected against in future generations, especially if these kinds of artificial intelligence, artificial life forms prove to be adaptive for the human species. Then maybe we would be okay with them if we looked at them and they don't quite look human, but they look close enough. That's a really good question.
You mentioned holodecks before, and I was thinking how, you know, even just like writing fiction or a fiction script is difficult. It would be almost impossible. It'd be so taxing to write a holo novel, having to just manage everything, the environment and the way the characters act, and then like multiple responses to things. And Tom Paris is always going on and on about building holo environments and holo novels. I'm not sure I can think of a less poetic soul on Voyager. Like, how is he creating all these environments. He's probably just using like the pre-made primitives and scripts to put the programs together. I think he's like the Squarespace of holodeck designers.
Yeah, probably. I mean, right? That's a really good analogy. That would be, you have the pros who build like your Twitters and your Facebooks, and then you have the Tom Parises who are using Squarespace and have web pages that say under
just
construction,
snapping them together.
Characters that say under construction on their foreheads.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, it's a really cool idea. I think it's definitely difficult for us to perceive how it could even be possible. I just think our ideas about reality and physics, I think humans in general, particularly Americans, and I think we're a little bit behind the curve of where science is on terms of what perception and reality is and what those things are. Like what science is starting to tell us that they are. So I think we're gaining knowledge that's leading us in that direction where we can do what they do. And I do think it's probably even sooner now, looking, you know, five, six years after that book was written, the knowledge that we've gained just in that time and kind of where it might push us and where it might lead us. I think right now in our near-term future, something like something that more feeds the brain sensory information that isn't actually there, but the brain perceives as though it is probably physical, more realistic than the way they conceived of a holodeck. But who knows? I think predicting this stuff is just absurdly hard. Unless you're building it yourself, there's no way. You're kind of just grasping at straws sometimes.
As a fiction writer and a screenwriter, I wanted to ask you, nobody argues the effectiveness of sci-fi as a tool for metaphor and allegory. Certainly, Star Trek has spent a lot of time examining social and technological issues in its stories. What I'm concerned about is the ability of humanity as an audience to listen to those lessons. You know, Star Trek speaks against racism and discrimination all the time, and yet we're living in one of the most hate-filled eras in history, and Trek warns us about ecological disaster, and we're facing a climate crisis that may now already be unstoppable. Why are we such a bad audience for these messages?
Because we have not evolved to the point that we can handle these problems yet. I was thinking about this actually this morning. We're still fighting two sort of systems. You know, we have our old brain system that kept us alive when we lived in caves, and then we evolved to have this sort of higher thinking capacity. And these two systems are often at war with each other. And what, you know, the older brain reacts quicker and faster and more negatively. And, you know, it's a human bias that we're really, really bad at sacrificing now to prevent something down the road. And one of the things that I think about all the time is that in Star Trek's history, much of which is still in our future, things get way worse on Earth before they get better, you know?
It's true.
A lot of ways, we've tracked some of the way they think things had played out. And I think about often, there's a line from First Contact that I think it's Troy who says, It brought humans together like never before when they realized they weren't alone in the universe. And I think, wow, that is such a poetic idea. I don't know that it's true, especially not right now. You know, I don't know that we would react that way. I would love to think that we would, but it's just, that's why I think I had asked my brother again, like, what does it take to get us to a society where everyone's needs are provided for, that we can move on to not just surviving, but actualizing and becoming the best versions of ourselves? Well, how do we get there? And in their history, it took a third world war and contact with a peaceful alien race who was in some ways the exact opposite of who humans were. So how it'll play out for us.
Yeah, they kind of lucked out there.
Right. And so how it will play out for us, I don't know. It's really hard for me to imagine a scenario where it plays out that way. Not the part where it gets worse. Those scenarios are the ones I dream about every night. I get those ones. But just the ones where we respond better. It's really easy to feel hopeless right now. But I do think that's one of the reasons that I spent my quarantine watching Star Trek, and I think for two reasons, because it gave me such comfort as a child. So I think it's just natural that in this period of like immense stress and uncertainty that I would just go back to something that gave me so much joy and so much comfort then, but also just because of what it represents. It's an ideal about what we could be that in a lot of ways seems like pretty damn good, yeah. Right? You can argue with elements of it, sure.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone argues or could reasonably argue that we would not be better off to get to that model.
Well, thanks so much, Justin, for talking with me today. And if people want to know more about you or your podcasts and Planet M, where can they go online?
I think probably the best place is my Twitter feed. I am @JustinMcLaughlin.
All right, great. Well, good luck with the new show.
Awesome. Thank you so much.